Welcome to all of you. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay, good. It's my role to introduce our two speakers, or our two colleagues who are in conversation, and to the session on transformation in higher education. Just to start off by introducing Professor Crane Sudeen, or perhaps before I even introduce Crane, just to say that although at the risk of sounding a bit cliche, if there are two people who do not need to be introduced, it would be these two. I suspect that the overwhelming majority of you who are in this session, in this very full room, either know their work, know them personally, have heard them speak, have read them, seen them engaged. But nonetheless, it is my job to do this, and so I'm going to do it. So Professor Crane Sudeen was the director of the School of Education here at UCT, and he's now currently our Deputy Vice Chancellor. Crane has published extensively in the areas of social difference, culture, education policy, comparative education, educational change, public history, popular culture, and the list goes on and on. He's involved in a number of local and national, international social and cultural organizations. He's the former chairperson of the District 6 Museum Foundation. He's the founder and past president of the World Council of Cooperative Education Societies. And perhaps the hottest seat that Crane has ever occupied, he was the chair of the Ministerial Committee on Transformation in Higher Education. And he's a fellow of a number of local and international universities and academies. Professor Jonathan Jansen is the Vice Chancellor and Rector of the University of Free State, and he's the President of the South African Institute of Race Relations. I'm just going to pick up on a couple of Jonathan's publications, one which I happen to have read with great fascination and interest in drawing from some of my own research. One book which he published in 2009 called Knowledge in the Blood, Confronting Race and the Apartheid Past. And it was listed as one of the best books of that year by the American Libraries Association. And then a new book called Schools That Work, where he uses video documentaries to capture what happens inside disadvantaged schools, which nevertheless produce fantastic results in physical science and mathematics in South Africa. It's a book that I certainly would be interested in picking up on. Now, what's clear from these very brief bio sketches is that there could not be two better qualified people to engage us around this topic today. And part of their qualification comes clearly from their scholarship. But as important as that particular contribution is, it comes through because of the leadership roles that they've played, because of their engagement as public intellectuals, and because of their contribution at all kinds of levels in our society. And so I think what I can say about Crane and Jonathan is that pretty much at every level, they have not only spoken truth to power, but they have lived that truth to power in a variety of different ways. And so what they share from us actually comes in an embodied form. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Craig.
Well, thanks very much to all of you for being here this afternoon. So I really have to restrain myself. I'm a teacher, and my inclination is to get up and move around. So keep that media eye on me, Don. So it's really great, everybody, to see you here. Great to have such a full house this afternoon. So what I'd like to do is to set the scene for this conversation. Many of you know Jonathan well. I know Jonathan well. I've known Jonathan for more than 20 years. But I have to say that every single time I've been in his presence, I've been shocked. I mean, he has that capacity to cut across things in a way which I can't think of any other South African. And that's quite an extraordinary thing to say, because I think I do know a pretty wide cross-section of really outstanding South Africans. Suelin was saying, just as we were outside there, that did you know that he can play the piano? I didn't know that at all. But he is probably the most compelling public figure in the country at the moment. And so what I'm hoping that we can do here this afternoon is to give ourselves an opportunity to hear him think aloud. And so I'm essentially going to be setting him off. I'm his catalyst here. What I really would like to think that we would have done by the end of this afternoon is for us to get an idea of what lies behind this courage. Is it foolishness? Is it bravado? What is it, Jonathan? And so it'll be great to be able to give him an opportunity to talk into some of the issues that have arisen. So we'll talk for about 40 minutes or so, after which we'll give you an opportunity to raise issues that might be of particular interest or concern to you. So let's kick this off, Jonathan. John, do you want to begin to share with us what you think these really big issues are which our country is going through at the moment? And give us a sense of what you think is behind all of these big issues. Now, it can't be difficult for you to take us straight to the heart of some of these things, because you're writing about them all the time. So, you want to...
Yeah, sure. Now,
he is going to stand.
I am.
Just make sure I put on this thing. You don't mind. So, thank you very much to everyone for coming back. I think of a lot of things to do on such a beautiful day, other than listening to a big black fat guy from the police station. Thank you so much for being here. It's been a wonderful two and a half days. I started off speaking on Wednesday night, Community Chess. Anybody, some of you were there, the Community Chess. It's the name we also gave to a well-endowed hooker from my hometown in the States. It's quite amazing the number of people who showed up there, deeply concerned about what's happening in Iraq. Did you know that the Community Chess building in Brixton used to be a mortuary? Yeah, they've since moved to Parliament. But it's very interesting. Very interesting. Last week, somebody sent me on Twitter an advert that they photographed of a racist in Bloemfontein who offered student accommodation to targeting my students. And in Afrikaans, it said, here is student accommodation for non-affirmative action women. That, by the way, there's many ways of saying white only. That's one of them. For non-affirmative action women. And I was deeply troubled by that, and immediately retweeted that to my 57,800 followers, most of whom are from Maharaj's office. But I retweeted this and just sent it out there. And what really scared me was not the racist behavior of a private resident offering her facilities for whites-only students. What really scared me was the reaction of a huge cross-section of South Africans to the exposure that I've given to this thing.
Unbelievable racism. Unbelievable. I'm just going to leave out the man people in our society, like Daniel Litt, Gomez, and Nazi on his proud website. I'm just going to leave that out because that doesn't deserve any, because he thrives on that kind of attention. But I'm talking about all of these South Africans that say, what the hell is wrong with that? She has the right to deny black people access because you people have affirmative action and BEE. I have to confess to you, I don't see the logic. And I'm not a BEE fan, but I don't see the logic of connecting efforts to correct the labor market that for centuries worked against black people. And a blatantly racist advertisement in the local Afrikaans newspaper, and I want to come to that in a minute, I just don't see the connection. But there was all this retaliatory stuff coming out, not just from mad writers, but from what did people say, so what's the fuss? And then, of course, the unbelievable logic that it's her property, she can do with it as she pleases. Okay? And Pierre Foss, very, put out a very timely piece which sort of said, listen, both in terms of the Constitution, as well as in terms of the Rental Housing Act, I didn't even know there was a Rental Act, you can actually go to prison for 2 years. It's not just that you violated the civil rights of people, you violated it. This is a criminal action, and so on. So, to this day, if you looked at my following me on Twitter, you'll see a constant barrage of mainly white South Africans. How on earth could you think there's anything wrong? We, of course, recorded, my students were very good to participate, particularly my white students, which is in itself, very, not just courageous, but also for me, a very satisfying thing, given where we were, and not too long ago as a university. So my white student says, I live in Burkestell. That has been exposed. So they have a black student call, and they will say, no, there's a waiting list, please, before. 2 minutes later, the white student calls, they say, come on, Midland, come immediately, there's black. And another white student calls, yeah, but that's black, it's still there. And we recorded that, and 2 days ago, we deposited all the evidence to the Human Rights Commission. Now, what that incident claimed for me revealed was 3 things. One is this fact, what I really wish and hope for and pray for every day, the fact that there is still a hard core of racism at the center of our society. I would want to believe it's a minority. I would like to believe that most of Africans understand the difference between right and wrong. But at the core of our society, in my view, there still is very hard core racism. Number two, what is also very clear to me, particularly from the lines of reasoning pursued by people in the social media, is the failure of education to correct thinking. So it's a failure of education. Somewhere along that line, somebody didn't think clearly, logically, justly, that it is wrong to discriminate. And let me just put my cards on the table here. In my allocation of resources at the university, I make absolutely no distinction between black and white, gay and straight, South African and Zimbabwean. I'm quite sure I would end up breaking a few laws because I can't see why a university cannot give a place to a deserving student from Namibia or Zimbabwe in the medical school. I just don't get it. I think that's wrong. A university must give access to anyone based on their. Secondly, it is very, very clear to me that if you are poor, and this again is the thinking that I think our education system fails to install, South Africa's past is not only a story of apartheid, it is also a story of capitalism. In other words, it's a story of keeping people poor, including Afrikaans. Well, you know, we've read a book called Skabigalister by Dan O'Meara. And so the notion that Bianca de Kuna who got all these distinctions, who, by the way, went to a school they call Cullen in Hansbein, and appeared in Liberia. When I saw that story, I called out, and I said, and because she lives in a flat with her mother, and her stepfather has died of cancer, and not too long ago, her biological father died as well, and she's there with another sibling in one bedroom in the house, but somebody else's flat, and she goes to a disadvantaged school, and she gets all of these distinctions. I couldn't care less whether she's pink or green or white. What I care about is the skin is square. And so we gave her a bursary to cover all of the costs, including meals, for the next 3 or 4 or 5 years of the studies. That is the right thing to do. And so to be just. Now it turns out that 85% of the resources of our university, particularly in terms of bursaries and scholarship, go to black students. That is also right, given where we come from. But we can be just in a non-racial sense, in serving the poor, without having to resort to the kind of behavior that in fact divides our people even more. And finally, for the second, what this case also showed me, or demonstrated to me, is the interlocking character of our institutions. You see, you can't transform a campus without transforming the community around it. Because those children, young people, students, go from the campus where they've just done a core curriculum that includes things from racism, back into a Dutch Reformed church, which is all right and conservative, and in many ways backward with regards to the theology. They're still debating the Bell Confession. Could they use up the democracy? And as I said in our Afrikaans newspaper, that caused a lot of trouble. I said, do you really think that when you get here every Monday, say, please, and we have the gates, and sort of say, but the side of two, later on, and you come here. It's not my God, and it's not my Bible, and it's not my theology, and it's certainly not my own. But people don't think about the blatant contradictions in all this morality here, you know, due to God and sense of money. So can you in fact change a campus without changing the community? Because those staff members and students go to the local hairdresser. And I think that is students that come back. To the gynecologist, to the dentist, back to the farm. And so how do we as schools and universities in particular address both of those issues? Mm-hmm. I just use that as a little case.
Yes, but then John, so you are a personal case study yourself in how this whole experience plays itself out. So here you make the decision to apply for the UC-ship at the University of the Free State. At the most difficult time of, if you like, this university's whole experience. And the university goes through incredible trauma. And I'm now referring to those, just to remind all of you, the incident which precipitated this investigation that I did with the rape students, where these four students, you'll remember, were accused of humiliating these custodial members of staff. And many of you who haven't seen, go and see that YouTube video about this incident. It's really interesting. But I'm much more interested in you, in how you arrived there in the heart of all of these difficulties. Now you're talking about this strategizing your way through, you know, the campus and the community, but you arrived there, and so I'm really curious about what's going through your head as you land in that particular context, as you now begin to have to make sense of what's going on and how you need to be conducting yourself. So it's yourself in the midst of all of this. You have no history with that area. You're not a known quantity in that kind of space. You know, you're here in a Western Cape. So do you mind just talking a little bit about just yourself entering into, if you like, the depths of these issues that you're talking about and your personal navigation through them?
Sure.
Just you personally.
Yeah, look, I think it wasn't that strange a place to begin with, because you recall that I was at the University of Pretoria for 9 years, actually, 7 active years. And so I'd seen that movie before. And the only thing that made the Free State, I think, slightly different was the fact that in addition to having, you know, all of the same cultural, political, and historical challenges, it was very rural. Free State is a rural. Bloemfontein is a small city, and it's intended to be rural, which is not the case with Pretoria. So Pretoria is faced with this enormous cosmopolitan kind of environment, you know, brought about by the seat of government being there, but then also, of course, all the embassies and stuff like that. So that transformed that city a lot faster. But yet we had basically two nationalisms up against each other that had not been challenged ever. And Basutu nationalism and an Afrikaner nationalism. And I knew the only way to transform that university is to bring people from all the provinces and other countries, which we did. And I'm sorry about your university, but it took some from this main road schools all the way to town. But so personally, I was not too bothered, you know, because I knew I'd worked with kids who speak Afrikaans who'd been traumatized by their second generation status after apartheid and so forth. So that wasn't too big a deal. But I also learned a few things that I messed up and been troubled myself by my own leadership at the University of Pretoria. And that is that you have to go in from the point of view that you too are part of the dilemma. That is, I didn't go in, here's this black guy who sorted out everything, who is morally just and ethically without having problems. I went in fully understanding as a result of my experiences that here you go in humbly, here you go in acknowledging your own demons, here you go in understanding that the best way to transform a place like the University of Pretoria or any university is from a position, paradoxically, you know, in Pauline terms, my strength made perfect in weakness. So I knew that kind of weakness was the best way in which to begin the dialogue. The first deal was hard, because everybody suspected you. The white folk thought you were an ANC plant, which I always found that was really fascinating. The ANC executive must have enjoyed that. Yeah, you know, and black people sort of thought, yes, the Manchurian candidate, you know, and something put into his head. But after a year, there was trust, because the one thing I've learned in this experience, after that first year, is your first disposition towards young people, especially in university, is love. And I don't mean love in the sugary sense of love. I mean love in the sense of a very deep commitment to you as a human being, irrespective of who you are. Once you get that out of the way, the rest is easy.
So, you tell these stories often about, you know, keeping an open door and these students coming in and out. Mm-hmm. And it's clearly been for the students at that university something completely different to what they had experienced before. But you've also annoyed a whole lot of other students who don't like all of this kind of...
They sent a lot of UCT. And
say it again. Not everybody.
No, it's true. Initially, that's an issue. But if you look at the SASCO leadership at our university today, these are sort of the students who believe they are the bearers, you know, of the flag for, you know, restoration and all of that. It's the smartest, most insightful, intellectually oriented student leadership we've ever had at any university, I can assure you, headed by a guy called Pirinati. But that is not an accident. That happened because of an upfront investment in which we said, this is not a place in which you get angry. This is a place in which you start by thinking, by reasoning, by using logic. So you get angry, there's no place for you at this university. If that anger can translate into a mature...
Sorry, can I just... Sorry,
Professor Yansen, I think you swallowed some of your words.
Okay, I'm not sure I've connected what you're saying, but I feel I'm speaking...
Well, I'm going to understand. It's time to...
Who said transformation was difficult? And so,
we worked with our people to sort of say, you cannot be like South Africa. One of the roles of the university is to get people to think about the most challenging and hurtful things rather than to fight about it. But that's the difference between the university and the gang. And so we consciously work with my team. I did very little, actually. I have a team that worked, right now I just spoke to somebody, working with young people to understand that you reason your way out of trouble. That's what universities are about. And as a result of that, we've not had, you know, any. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't a place for protest, there isn't a place. I'd like to see more of that. But what it does mean is you begin by saying, what is the real problem here? So I can assure you, in 2009, if something like this happened with a racist ad, the university's windows would have been smashed. There have been protests all over this campus. But now the students think, this is not the university. This is a racist auntie in the town. That's what we must do in order to make sure that we have a more perfect country, and so on and so forth. So I don't think you'll find that. You'll find it sometimes. The BITS students are probably the worst. So when I go to BITS, they start maybe a bunch of black students in a corner. Whenever I go, I'm not going to go get them all back. And they start to swear at you. You haven't even spoken at me. I'm serious.
Yeah.
They are going to sue me literally as old as, you know, these are pomtoxies. Pomtoxies, you know, they pretend to be radical, they're actually thugs.
So there are two things that come out of this. I mean, one of them, which I think the audience would really appreciate hearing, is that you decided that you would take back into the university one of these four students who was at the heart of this race incident.
Yeah, in the marketing department.
And this student comes back and it really is quite an extraordinary moment, because it was in this vein of what you're talking about, a great act of love on your part. Do you mind telling us how this has turned out? I mean, what's become of this young man?
Well, first of all, you know, most people look at this from a distance, you know, don't understand that there was both the issue of justice as well as the issue of reconciliation. And the recognition, of course, that you can't solve complex human problems only through the law. And so once he had both paid the price, both in the civil courts as well as in the criminal court, it was very important for us to reach out. And so Nelson Mandela, in fact, said this. None of these things are original, as you know. Nelson Mandela, in fact, said of the wardens, you know, we must surprise them with acts of love. And I found that quote somewhere, which I'll share with you. And that for me is very powerful. So he then was the first of four young men who understood the nature of the crime. And when that happened, you didn't want to be in the room. It was a breaking down that I've never seen before. And it was that kind of, I know you interacted with him as well, it was that kind of recognition, the shame, the guilt, the stuff that he would have to bear for the rest of his life. And it was on that basis that I said, if this cannot be a country that leaves open the door for the perpetrator, especially a young kid, to begin to mend his ways. He went on his own to Pretoria Chavo, which is a deep rural area of the Eastern Free State, to work with black people. He didn't tell them who he was. To serve people there, his parents, if you will, to try and make up, and not a day goes by where I don't meet with him in which he expresses remorse. Now, I don't want you to...
No, but is that remorse? You know, just thinking about the yeah, complex things that are going through his head here, is that remorse, I'm just talking to all of us here, something which we as South Africans, you know, ought to be looking forward to or trying to run away from?
I think it's a remorse that we have to... You've got to get to that point. All of us. I have remorse in my heart, and I've told you this before, but the many years in which I hated white people, I thought I had a decent gripe with white South Africans from Lansdowne to Montague. And I had to recognize that in order to move beyond it. So I don't think the issue is, as I said to Darlene Crowder many times, you must not get stuck there. what you're going to do is work with you to turn that remorse into some way in which you can serve. So the other day, the Human Rights Commission asked us to investigate a racist church in the Free State. And Dadi came to me and said, "Prof, please can I lead that project? Because I think I know how to help him get out of that."
So I was going to ask you another question. It was if you'd been listening to me, I said that there were two issues. And I won't go to the second one, but I want to build on now just what you're talking about. About learning through this remorse. And thinking about the role of institutions like universities in coming to deal with this incredible psychosocial experience which the country is going through. How do we, in a sense, not only magnify but duplicate? How do we take that kind of moment and make it part of our learning in a way which is not so traumatic that everybody, which I think is what happens. The minute you start talking about the past, and many of you here in the audience will know this, our students say, "Sorry, I've heard enough about this. Stop talking to me, please." You know, and can't you give that up? I mean, how do we hold on to that without a sense of losing, if you like, the opportunity that this represents?
Yeah. Is it the left? Okay, so I think that it depends on which community you talk to, right? So let's talk students. I think there's a case trained for every university to have a core curriculum, because we're training students before they're educated, you know. And that's a big South African dilemma, you know, that mistake you're going to have with the British. You're going to put kids into engineering in the first year class, they're not going to be educated. And so the core curriculum, as you know, that I deal with, one of the questions in that core curriculum is, how should we deal with our writing class? And the first few lectures, it are simply spent trying to convince the students about the present past. In other words, Ronaldo in that racist ad, I want to also move on and say to the students, I'm desperate to get, I don't like wallowing in the past. The problem is you keep living like that. Ronaldo just brought it out again. So unless you can talk through this, you will not have a language. You will not have a politics in the best sense of that to be able to engage a crisis when it hits you in the eyes. But that case must be made rather than assumed by those of us who lived on that side of the internet before. That's as well. As far as the parents and adults and so on are concerned, I think there's a very strong case to be made to become involved. Dion Sema, for me, is a great South African. He goes to the scene of the Worcester bombing and works for the perpetrators and the victims. This is one example. You know, the people from the clothing bank that I met this morning for the breakfast in town, who work with women, black women, to empower them, you know, to be able to start their own businesses and deal with violent relationships. In other words, instead of making this intellectual exercise in which you reflect in your room on your guilt or remorse, how about begin to turn the energy you all have into the kinds of projects that your Alexander so poignantly spoke about that indeed make a difference as a way of getting over, okay, those injustices in which some of us benefited and the majority not. So that is the way to deal with it. And as I said to Dani, throw yourself to the service of other people, which it has, as opposed to simply sitting there, because that has all sorts of health and other kind of consequences if you don't act on it.
So we're not being provocative enough in the way in which we're setting up our curriculum in universities.
We're scared to talk about these things. And the problem is, if you don't talk, do you think I enjoy exposed to people in my backyard for their racism? Do you think I enjoy it? Speaking to a guy yesterday, a phone crew following me throughout. I don't know why people say, I must be on my way out of life because they are following me with the cameras everywhere. Yesterday, these guys followed me all over the Cape Flats, you know, where I grew up. And you're stuck in a place, and you know, I am absolutely crazy about it. I mean, this, I believe, is Cape Town's contribution to civilization with samosa. So, the right thing is to be used. And so suddenly, at one of my primary schools, there's a plate of samosas. I said, it's bad. One idiot who got letters, they all went on print, and guys, doesn't he coolly samosas? I said, oh my God, even in our ordinary language, this is a man who's 60 years old. Okay. So my thing is, do we speak about these things in a way that avoids such incredible tragedy and the life of the grown up? And unless we do it in our churches, our mosques, and our synagogues, unless we do it in our homes, our schools, and our universities, we're not going to get out of this life. It's now 20 years. People are getting better. And by the way, if you and I don't deal with those issues, that space will be full by the junior minors. It will be full by angry people. And that will come.
So how do you link in this with this whole need, actually, to maintain our institutions as excellent institutions, world-class institutions?
Yes.
Is there a contradiction between what you're talking about and academic excellence?
Absolutely not. I mean, there's all sorts of ranking systems going around, and I'm really proud of this university where I'm from. This is a very good university. And I mean that. The problem for us is that the metrics we use to determine goodness or to determine quality are so narrow. Okay? So, for example, one of the most common metrics used in managing universities is how many times you are cited by your peers in top journals in the world. Now, I like that, by the way. As a traditional academic, I like that. But unless you make a difference in sorting out the problems of sanitation and nature, you want to mark a great university. You see, both matter. And we are good at some things, but not good at, unless you can produce students. You know, I saw the other day, I'm not going to tell you which university in Cape Town this guy graduated from. But I went to Glendrow to send my daughters, we bought our daughter a car because, you know, she now needs to work. I haven't completed a degree at our university. So I went to Glendrow there in Saxon. And this white guy looks at me with my shorts and my dirty shirt and that cap. And his hand is my and says, "You were there, you need a job." I didn't respond. And then said, "You've got the voice of James Earl Jones. I can use you on my shop floor." And so I looked at him and I said, "Sir, I'm so grateful that this is not me. The people are here. You know, if anything comes up, sir, give me a call." So I gave him my card. And then things we're dealing with here is not simply the open air blatant acts of racist aggression. It's the microaggressions, as the professor at Columbia University calls it, I'm getting started, Professor Sue. It's the microaggressions, it's the everyday things. As I said of the English language, there was a lot of people condemned for this, but I was thinking of you guys.
Who are you talking about?
Englishness in South Africa, which has never been interrogated. The Afrikaner is an easy target to cut. But as I said in the Percy Banishek lecture, which I'll give to you if you're interested, is just the way you speak English, just the way in which you come across. I said English is still the only South African language in which you can make somebody feel small without uttering a word. And so these are the microaggressions, colored racism by which you and I write. All of these things that appear to be normal, but in everyday life, makes people feel small or big. And it's being conscious of that that I think is the connection to a better society, and which I still believe, by the way.
One more question before we give the audience an opportunity to pose a question, because we're running out of time here. So do you mind just talking very quickly to, and you evoked that image now of a disadvantaged person coming into the institution and finding his or her voice, his or her capacity, for whatever it might be. I mean, are we succeeding at that?
I think we are. Look at the claims that, as you know, over since the 90s, I mean, we're really succeeding in the problem of access for young people to qualify. Just talking about the point of entering the university, I'm not talking about the school system right now. And we've done it well. So as a proportion, you know, of the total enrollments, as you know, I mean, we've done extremely well. I think we can do better, but we've done well. What we haven't done well with is what happens in terms of the content of the experiences, not only curricula, you know, of young people when they come inside our universities. Why are so many young people at your university, particularly black young people, angry? Why are so many black staff at this university angry? I just spoke to several of them the other day. This is a great university, the buildings are good, you've got a great reputation. So why are people so angry? There's something in the experience of being in education that can either be alienating or empowering. And what do people learn in the process, apart from a different accent? What do they learn that genuinely empowers them to be bridge builders? And stop thinking of young people only as contributors to the economy. That's a narrow view of education, an important view, but a narrow view. And how do we prepare them to live together, to learn together, and if we're lucky, to love together?
Thank you. So, I'm very conscious of giving you also an opportunity to participate in this conversation. So there's a lot more to talk to Jonathan about. I really would have liked him to have had the opportunity to just think aloud again, as I said before, about these spats that he's had with government, with the ways in which he's been, if you like, criticised for taking positions that government has felt uncomfortable with about. Really interesting to pursue that. Also think it would have been interesting for us to hear Jonathan talk about this ecology he's trying to create in Bloemfontein with these campus and the community. Afterwards, Don, you know, there may be ways in which we can start picking these things up for the benefit of more people than simply, you know, people here. But I'd like to now give you an opportunity to maybe make a comment, pose a question if you'd like. Not to give a lecture, please. But just to get us going, please.
I admire you very much, Rick. I'm for all your talks and read everything and all of that. And I would love to see you, and you see, can you hear me? I would love to see you at UCT one day in the distant future when, as a member of staff or a vice chancellor, it would be lovely to have you here.
Okay, thank you. I can tell you a story about that.
when I saw the school results on the first day, the first thing that came to my mind, I wondered if you could see that and had anything to do with that.
Have anything to do with that? You hear that, Don? If you have anything to do with the Free State getting the top results in the country.
It must be horrible to have two terrible experiences in Cape Town. First of all, you're happy to get into a final, and then of course you're not from 1 to 4. That was too horrible. On a more serious note, the secret to the success of the Free State is the following. Number one, a really great MECU is deeply passionate about education. I'm not seen that, and I'm not a DA person, just for the record. I've not seen that passion for education since I was a kid. Tate Markway is absolutely amazing. So this man lives in the schools, and I work with him in schools. The second secret is there's only 332 high schools. And so when we discuss strategy, it was very, very clear that the way to get the results up was to work with the worst schools and leave the good schools alone, like UNICE, Grey, Picard Park, and Jean Pochier. And the third strategy was to not, in fact, work with the 30-40% benchmark, but to work with the 50% benchmark. And so if you look at the worst schools in the Free State, you'll notice their highest marks are in mathematics. The highest marks are in the sciences, and that's not an accident. And then just perhaps finally, for taking well, and which I'm really happy that our university put a lot of resources, we take about 40 million rand and put it into the school's project and so on for the department, is that it understands you cannot do this alone, that you needed to involve the NGOs, the private sector, families, churches, there's not too many mosques, one sort of. But everybody got involved at the community level, especially in the rural Free State and with the schools. And so I'm really proud about the fact that we are working on the quality issue in the worst schools and not simply in getting the numbers up.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Professor Just, I think you started off by saying that your admissions program is on merit, which is, of course, what one would like to see throughout the world. And whilst there is obviously the need of admissions programs at different universities, but and then you talk about anger, and there is anger in Fuller Hall where some really top students have not been able to get into medicine, and other people have been given the chance, which is fair enough. But I just like your comments on your admission on that.
Yeah, look, I think we may, especially, I mean, the real trouble, as you know, in universities is in medicine, not in architecture or physiotherapy, or certainly not teaching education. The real trouble is in medicine. So one of the things that really troubles me at all angles, especially at our university, is the first thing my parent assumes at my university is my kid didn't get in because of black kids in the life. And I have to sort of say, you know, understand what he's saying is wrong. And so we looked at dealing with the equity excellence thing by setting the bar high for all our students and then going out there. So I spent a lot of my time in schools, in Menzi High School, for example, one of the best high schools in the country in math and physical science, to get those students to medicine. So I don't think what we should do is tamper with the standard of admission. What we should do is make sure more kids pass well in high school so they can complete a medical job in getting access to the so-called high status disciplines. But if you don't do that, you get this resentment you've seen with the Ramel issue.
So, please, at the back there.
Hi, Chris Jenkins. It's a privilege to be here to speak. I just wanted to say, actually, Rabbi Hassan, you spoke about migration of wrestling and just how you can begin to, outside higher education, get people, well, empower people with new language. How do you begin to help them about their consciousness? I've been in a conversation where I walked away and felt really embarrassed about what some of my references are saying, but I realized that they don't have that language. How do you begin to think about their consciousness?
Yeah. You know, there's a subject in schools. The question
is essentially about how one deals with the pervasive microaggression that is manifest in the country. Outside the university.
And I think the first thing that we need to do across our country, thank you very much. The first thing that we need to do is to consider what I call the interlocking institutions and sort of say, how can we begin right at the beginning? And that is with children, with young children. How do you develop an alternative language register other than the one we inherited? How do you not say coolie cookie for a subversive? How do you not insult people, okay, by talking down to them? So you need to develop and so a lot of work needs to be done, for example, how do you raise children in a way that deals with the issue of how do you talk about others and yourself. Then, of course, in the schools, now there's an interesting thing in the schools, forget universities, called life orientation. If you want a high mark, you do life orientation. And the average since 1994 has been 90%. You see it. So the kid gets 10% in everything, or 30%, but 90% life orientation. Now, my son teaches life orientation at the Johannesburg School, so I've become really proud. But I can't think of a more powerful site to begin to talk about the problem we're dealing now today. Do you know how really this discussion takes place in South Africa? In any form. And so I think part of what we need to do, as, and I like your question, in terms of this consciousness raising, is break it out into various forms. So when you talk about how to keep your community safe because of the incidents of crime and customers, whatever the case might be, let's talk about how we talk about crime, about how we assume who the criminal is. You know what I mean? Make it part of a broader discussion rather than have a module on race or a, you know, once a year event in which we all feel guilty. And so, but it starts with us. Just change. I still think, I've been thinking a lot with the man we all admire, Nelson Mandela. Why is it that Nelson Mandela is such a powerful figure in all of our lives? You know, I believe there's some of the most regular writing people crying when you talk about Nelson Mandela in 1995 in the South Africa that I grew up in. It's one of the reasons that we. And that is the power of personal example to actually influence so many millions of people in South Africa and around the world. And so I still believe, I know this has got evangelical sort of meanings to it, but I still believe in the power of the personal example that all can demonstrate to young people.
Okay.
Thank you, Rafian, for an inspiring conversation. I'm Lucy Lewigan, I'm part of the Transformation Services Office here at UCT, and I work with a lot of Craig. I wanted to hear a little bit about your project, the No Student Handbook Project, and specifically, how has this project contributed to the students' academic and social attention at the university, and what would you say is an example of ones that can use for other institutions like us?
Nobody wants to talk about how many students at a university. Nobody. Everybody assumes that students at the university have sorted themselves out. Right? The truth is at your university, at every university in this country, there's a percentage of students who are not sure, who are what, to use technical language, are food insecure, meaning they can't predict where the next university is going to come from. Now, that's a very serious thing, especially for talented students in terms of concentration in the class, all of the stuff we know about. But there's another value to this. We've got something called the Human Project, the Academic Project, which today's academic standards of the Human Project. One of the reasons the volunteers on this project, including my wife and the Dean of Students, who work long hours in the project, one of the reasons they believe you can bring a sense of humanity to the campus, a sense of recognition of people who are not recognized, is simply by dealing with this most basic of needs, which is hunger, you know, the need to eat. And so that had a huge impact, we believe, on the poorest of the poorest students. But it also demonstrated to the other students, you know, that this university actually cares about you, not just in terms of potential subsidy income, but in terms of your values and your freedom. You get to do those things among many others. Then you begin to talk to transformation.
Okay, so where is Janice now? I want to get a sense of the time. I'll come to you in a moment. Janet, Claire, so we have to finish here at 1 o'clock. I mean, 2 o'clock, sorry. We can go over a few minutes. Yes? You're willing to tolerate that?
Yes!
Great. Okay, so let's have a conversation from the back there.
Professor, just a brief question. I understand that you send scouts down to the organic tracks to the good schools like Longwell and Five Road, and then you poach them or scout for them. Come and take him to the Free State University.
You understand that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So what's the question? Now, by the way, I like the notion of young people traveling and experiencing different parts of South Africa. I think it's important for every Cape Town kid to understand that creation extends beyond Solaris parts. And, no, seriously, one of the most dangerous thing is caught against the sea as you are, is that people really think this is the world. There's a whole lot of people I can tell you on the Cape of Flats who have never had a decent conversation with somebody who would be native to management. That's bad for you. Okay? That's not good for your future. And so you need to, in fact, break out. The same is to the Free State kids. I encourage the students at the top schools in the Free State to go and study, at Stellenbosch, go to Johannesburg and study. It is very, very important.
And Cape Town, huh?
Yeah. If you're going to watch a more than Cape Town,
my question is, how do you deal with sexism on your campus? Because it isn't just the racism that we face in South Africa, but the violently asserted dominance of men over women that destroys everyone's chances of learning.
Our starting point at the Institute, headed by Professor Andre Kiert, our starting point is that South Africa's original sin isn't race. Its original sin is difference. So whether that difference is Jewish or Muslim, whether that difference is gay or straight, whether that difference is... So, I mean, probably right now, for example, for welcoming the first years, and I told all the first years and their parents, if you are racist, I don't want you at this university, leave now. If you're a sexist, that was my second, I don't need you at this university, leave now. And I went on and on and on. I spoke about homophobia and all of that stuff. So you've got to deal with this stuff as a package, because the issue of xenophobia, I make it very clear that I'm giving your money, and I'm saying this live for the first time, I give your money as taxpayers, which I'm not supposed to do, by the way, to fund top students from Zimbabwe. Not because they're from Zimbabwe, but because they deserve funding to study. And so, and also because in the back of my mind, I remember the xenophobia that was ruined this kind of thing. You with me? So you're quite right, and sexism is at the heart of, when you hear content, the data that I saw this morning, one-third of men said that at some point they raped a woman. My God, you've got to talk to these things. I agree.
Okay, so let's take a last comment from the front here, please.
There's one up there.
Okay. No, can't hear you.
Sorry, I met Lily to talk with great interest, and then I went on to read Lily to talk, and I was struck by the greater urgency of the second book. Can you account for that, Professor?
For the what? The
need to act.
Yes. I don't know. Sometimes I have to worry that I'm becoming paranoid. But maybe it's because I sort of tend to look into the future more than into the past. And I worry about the fact that you cannot account for more than 500,000 kids since grade 2 who showed up or didn't show up in grade 12. I worry about the fact that so many young people are unemployed. I worry about the fact that I've seen in post-colonial Africa that when you make promises, and you can't deliver, that people eventually turn on themselves and especially on others. So I'm looking down that little bit of saying, that's why what the minister does in this orgy of self-congratulation every year is she talks about the kids who made it, she doesn't tell me about the kids who didn't get there. That worries me. Kuseni Lamini in Business Day said, this man is unpatriotic. Now, you can call me anything. And I've been called the son of many things before. But when you call me unpatriotic, something deep inside me is disturbed. And we need to teach our young people that commitment and criticism is the same thing. And that one of the roles Craig and I have and you have is to recognize that our only client is the truth. And that for me is about heart. Now, by the way, there has to be a space in our society for people who can be critical outside of a party political framework. Now, I am, I'll confess this in my second confession of the day, I am wildly in love with Mongela Ake. I'm there, Nico, I know, but the moment she gave up that public independent space, and thereby she's seen differently. I'm not saying it's around me, I'm just saying it's seen differently. And you must have more space. The problem is when there are not enough people in that space of independence, you stand up like a sofa, and it's actually quite a dangerous place to be.
Okay, last comment, please.
Professor, so you've got how many students admitted that they were racist or sexist and got out?
You asked
people to leave if they were prepared to admit that they were racist or sexist. I'm prepared to lay out that nobody left.
That's right.
But do you think that there is any possibility that simply by asking that question you get people sufficiently to think about it to actually change their behavior?
That the purpose of the question is not to sort of say, to baptize all of them as non-racist. The purpose of the question is to say, even if you think it, let me warn you, you're in the wrong class. Okay? And in fact, if you look at the rest of the speech which was published by several newspapers, it sort of says, welcome. Be part of this journey, and there's still some stuff. But I have to upfront. The seniors I get, which wasn't always the case, but I have to upfront sort of says, understand. Another message is for the students, that message actually for the parents. Understand where you're going to. Before I sit down, can I just say something? I came in very early, I was a bit upset because, I squeezed a lot into a day when I'm out of town. And so I was here an hour before the time, actually 1.5 hours before the time. So then I ran into an older woman near the shop. And I was so moved. And she said to me, I want you to know that one of the main reasons I came from Johannesburg was to come and be here to listen to you today. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful. Thank you very much. It was great.
So one of the important things in closing comments is acknowledging what's happened here today. This is summer school, with the emphasis on school. We come here to learn. And so I want to thank all of you for participating in what I think has been a really important learning experience. I was really anxious in thinking about how we were going to manage this session this afternoon, how we would be able to retain both the edge, criticality, talk academic language, but at the same time to be stimulating an environment here in which we can listen. And I think that we've done really well. I think the questions have been really insightful questions. I think that the last question in particular, I think, is a really important question. Question that I think very appropriately brings this session to a response. So please, ma'am, thank you all for being here this afternoon and for having come. Some of you, I know, from a great long distance, and a big thank you to Jonathan. Is an encore. I was once, I said this to Claire the other day, it was quite extraordinary. I never experienced it, and I haven't said this to Donovan before. He and I were going into an academic meeting, and we were going to speak on this platform together. And before he even spoke, people had stood up and rapturous applause. He hadn't said a word. We're a whole lot more restrained, but there is somebody who desperately wants to have a question answered. So, have you got the question on that piece of paper there, Jonathan?
Yeah. You better read it.
Ask John Jackson if he'd like to stand for president.